his bloody tongue. Hear him yellow blood in war. Do you believe in his sweet sensation? Do you believe in second chance? Do you believe in Rapture Bay?
Do you believe in Rapture by Thurston Moore, performing at Smith College years ago? This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Former Vice President Dick Cheney has died at the age of 84. He was a key architect of the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the so-called U.S. War on Terror after 9/11. Cheney was a leading defender of the U.S. torture program in expanding the power of the presidency and vice presidency. Just days after the 9/11 attacks, Cheney appeared on Meet the Press and said the U.S. would have to work on what he called the dark side.
We also have to work, though, sort of the dark side, if you will. We've got to spend time in the shadows and in the intelligence world. A lot of what needs to be done here will have to be done quietly, without any discussion, using sources and methods that are available to our intelligence agencies, if we're going to be successful.
Vice President Cheney would go on to push for the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 under the false pretext of preventing Saddam Hussein from developing weapons of mass destruction.
In the case of Iraq, we have a regime that is busy enhancing its capabilities in the field of chemical and biological agents and is, by all available evidence, speeding up its nuclear weapons program.
Over the years, Dick Cheney repeatedly defended the U.S. invasion, which led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands and destabilized the Middle East.
Did in Iraq was exactly the right thing to do. If I had it to recommend all over again, I would recommend exactly the right same course of action.
Cheney was widely accused of pushing for the U.S. invasion of Iraq to benefit his former company, Halliburton, the world's second-largest oil services company. In 2007, the former Federal Reserve Chair, Alan Greenspan, said, quote, "I'm saddened that it's politically inconvenient to acknowledge what everyone knows. The Iraq war is largely about oil," unquote. Dick Cheney also played a key role in developing the U.S. torture program and global secret detention program. In an interview in 2008, ABC's Jonathan Carl questioned Cheney about the treatment of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was held in a secret CIA prison where he was waterboarded over 100 times.
Did you authorize the tactics that were used against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed?
I was aware of the program, certainly, and involved in helping get the process cleared. That is, the agency, in effect, came in and wanted to know what they could and couldn't do. And they talked to me as well as others to explain what they wanted to do, and I supported it. There was a period of time there, 3 or 4 years ago, when about half of everything we knew about al-Qaeda came from that one source. So it's been a remarkably successful effort. I think the results speak for themselves.
In hindsight, do you think any of those tactics that were used against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others went too far?
I don't.
And on KSM, one of those tactics, of course, widely reported was waterboarding, and that seems to be a tactic we no longer use. Even that, you think, was appropriate?
I do.
Dick Cheney first came into the spotlight in the 70s when he served as President Ford's chief of staff. He went on to serve in Congress, where he famously voted against a resolution calling for the release of Nelson Mandela in South Africa, then served as defense secretary for George H.W. Bush and oversaw the first Gulf War and the U.S. invasion of Panama. Later in life, Cheney became a vocal critic of Donald Trump, especially as Trump intensified his criticism of his daughter, Liz Cheney, who served as Republican congresswoman. Dick Cheney said, quote, "In our nation's 248-year history, there's never been an individual who's a greater threat to our republic," unquote. He was talking about President Trump. We're joined now by John Nichols, executive editor of The Nation, author of many books, including The Rise and Rise of Richard B. Cheney, Unlocking the Mysteries of the Most Powerful Vice President in American History. John, we only have a few minutes here, but if you can talk about the significance of the man who was considered the most powerful vice president in U.S. history.
But there is no question. He was the most powerful vice president in American history. That is not a debatable point. He positioned himself to be George W. Bush's vice president. Bush was struggling as a relative newcomer to the national stage and not doing all that well. And he was looking for someone with a lot of experience in government to take that number two job. Cheney did this as a former White House staffer in the Nixon and Ford eras, as a longtime congressman, as a former Secretary of Defense, as someone who himself, he had tried to be a presidential candidate, but never gotten much traction. So Cheney wanted to be at the center of power. Bush accepted him and brought him in. Because of his immense experience, Cheney asserted himself in all sorts of ways, but especially on foreign policy. And in the aftermath of 9/11, there is simply no question that Dick Cheney sought to put the United States in position to make huge moves in the Middle East, military moves, and ultimately to do an invasion and what became essentially an occupation of Iraq. That was done on the basis of claims that were unfounded and proved to be incredibly controversial, even at the time, it faced a great deal of protest. And I think this is the thing to understand. Dick Cheney, if you see him in the long arc of his career, is someone who really made the modern Republican Party what it is, a party that sought power at this intersection of economic power and political power, and sought to make moves that were often, that very beneficial to the people who had that power, but very destructive, very challenging to the trajectory of the world. I understand how at the end of his career, Dick Cheney was hypercritical of Donald Trump, that he saw in Donald Trump a leader who was acting in ways that were and moving in ways that were incredibly destructive and incredibly dangerous. But it is important to understand that before he came to that point, Dick Cheney was seen in much the same way. And it was because both as a public face of his party and the administration he was in, but also as a behind-the-scenes operator, he was someone who I think a great many Americans came to recognize as an individual who wanted to exercise power in ways that were clearly beneficial to his political circle, to his economic allies, but that really did put the United States in some terrible places diplomatically and politically around the world. And I would last thing I would say is that Dick Cheney was also someone who operated very aggressively as vice president and in other positions at the domestic level. And he was a very ardent advocate for massive tax cuts for the rich, et cetera. And so it is very hard to delink Dick Cheney, a very fascinating, very complex man, from the evolution of the Republican Party that he ultimately came to criticize.
And John, I wanted to ask you specifically about the war in Iraq. Cheney, while he was part, along with Don Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz of the Project for the New American Century, was sought regime change for Iraq as early as 1998, years before they actually came up with this excuse for invading Iraq.
Well, remember that Dick Cheney had been Secretary of Defense under George H.W. Bush and had been an advocate for action against Iraq back in 1990, 1991. And so you can really trace with Cheney something, a focus on Iraq, some would say an obsession, that was very intense and that often put him at odds with people who said, look, the real problem is here. The real challenge is elsewhere. And one of the things about Dick Cheney was that when he became fixated on something, he didn't let go. And he was very willing to, keep pressing, even if his policies were exceptionally unpopular. And I think that ultimately the invasion of Iraq and what came after proved to be immensely unpopular. The American people recognized that this was something that was developed and organized in the White House, but not based on anywhere near the level of consultation or the level of international engagement and reflection that was needed. And so Cheney had a reputation as, you know, this major player, particularly on the global stage. And yet often, if you look back on it, there were moves that he made, steps that he organized, steps that he pushed for, that proved to be disastrous and that proved to be wrong. And so, again, I think Cheney's an incredibly complex man. And I think he is fascinating. I think he definitely committed himself to a life of public service. There is no question of that. And yet, in that public service, even going back to the 1970s, you see an effort or willingness to err on the side of secrecy, on the side of power politics, to not consult Congress, to actually insult Congress, and to concentrate power in the presidency, in the White House, to do the things that he and his allies wanted to do. And then, yes, as we note, he then became a very stark critic of Donald Trump for using that concentrated power, ultimately to force his own daughter, Cheney's own daughter, from a position of leadership in the House of Representatives. And I do think that, again, if we look at where the Republican Party is today, and how it sees the presidency as almost an unlimited base of power and a base of power to make not just political moves, but economic moves. I think you have to recognize Cheney as someone who created that and who played an absolutely central role in telling Republicans that if you get power, you should do what you want to do.
John Nichols, I want to thank you for being with us, executive editor of The Nation, author of many books, including The Rise and Rise of Richard B. Cheney, Unlocking the Mysteries of the Most Powerful Vice President in American History. Coming up, we speak to the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters Carol Lenig and Aaron Davis about their blockbuster new book out today, Injustice, How Politics and Fear Vanquished America's Justice Department. Stay with us. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We spend the rest of the hour with two Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters who have a blockbuster new book out today. It's called Injustice, How Politics and Fear Vanquished America's Justice Department. Carol Lenig and Aaron Davis join us now in our New York studio. Carol is a longtime investigative reporter who worked at The Washington Post from 2000 to, well, just recently this year, a quarter of a century, five-time Pulitzer Prize winner. Aaron Davis is an investigative reporter with The Washington Post who's twice won the Pulitzer Prize. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! You write in the introduction, quote, "The Department of Justice collided violently with Donald Trump in his rise to power, and for the first time in history, our nation's rule of law was brought to the precipice of collapse," unquote. If you can talk about how the Department of Justice's core mission unraveled under Trump. I mean, the title of your book is Injustice.
You know, Amy, thanks for having us, first off. It is amazing to both Aaron and me, as we went through this process of reporting, how much more damaging Donald Trump's first presidency was to the core of the Justice Department. People there were individually targeted by a president, something that had never happened before. They were humiliated. Their careers were tarnished. Some of their careers were ruined. They were put under investigation by Republicans at Donald Trump's behest. The targeting left scars that weakened the resolve. His brand of bare knuckles kind of attacks changed the trajectory of what the Justice Department would do when Joe Biden ultimately took office?
One of the stories, the amazing stories that you tell are about this reporting into Trump's relationship with the Egyptian government early on, and $10 million that was supposedly being funneled or attempted to be funneled by Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi to Trump. Could you talk about that and how the Justice Department tried to investigate that? Or,
you know, I'd like Aaron to do it. He would be great for this.
And Aaron, as you do it, why don't we go back just a few weeks ago to the signing of the so-called ceasefire in Sharm el-Sheikh. There was President Trump. There was the Egyptian President al-Sisi. And this is what Trump said.
There was a reason we chose Egypt, because you were very helpful and very, very helpful. Everybody wanted to have this, but we really thought it was appropriate. And you are a great leader. You have very little crime. You have problems that other countries don't have. And, of course, nothing's perfect, but the job you do is amazing, and I want to thank you. Another one, he's been my friend right from the beginning, during the campaign against crooked Hillary Clinton. Have you heard of her?
So he ends with crooked Hillary. Why is he bringing her up as they're signing the so-called ceasefire in Sharm el-Sheikh? Talk about what you exposed.
Well, I did see some people take note of that comment just a few weeks ago. To Carol's point where we started here a minute ago, you know, we did look at the Department of Justice and like, why did the investigations into Trump go so slowly when he got to January 6th? And if you back up, you do realize that, you know, things happened. A lot of things happened that we knew inside the Justice Department. There are things we didn't know that happened inside the Justice Department that really made people feel reticent to go after Trump again and to really look hard at him. And one of them was this investigation into Egypt and whether Donald Trump had taken a foreign campaign contribution from the government of Egypt, specifically one that the U.S. intelligence had information from an informant that it was directed specifically by the president of Egypt, Fattah al-Sisi, in the run-up to the first election when he was running against Hillary Clinton.
When he was out of money, Trump, and his own campaign folks were saying, you got to put your own money into this.
Had a very critical moment. You know, this was, it's hard to remember, but Donald Trump was forecasted to lose that election against Hillary Clinton. It was a big surprise back in 2016. He was reticent to put in any more money into his own campaign. They could barely fund the rest of the campaign commercials that they had already promised to pay for. And so, you know, suddenly there's this largest contribution to Donald Trump's campaign ever by himself, $10 million. And that just happens to be right at this exact same time that the U.S. intelligence is hearing from an informant that el-Sisi is sending $10 million to Trump. And so those comments combined with some...
In two bags that weigh 200 pounds, almost the entire...
I did bury the lead, yes.
The Egyptian government, it was almost all the U.S. currency they had.
So our reporting is that, in fact, yes, there was $10 million. It wasn't just that they had an informant saying it. The Mueller investigation had found that, in fact, there were two bags weighing some 200 pounds total of U.S. $100 bills that left a bank in Egypt near the Cairo airport from an account that was controlled by the government's secret service, essentially. And so they tried to track that back and see if that ever came to Trump. But the Mueller investigation was hesitant to look directly into Trump's bank account, specifically after he had gone into the White House. And then that continued when the other political appointees also said, we don't really need to go there. Is there really predicate for this investigation? And they allowed that Egypt investigation to die a slow death inside the Department of Justice, even to the point of when one of new Trump's appointees comes in. They have this briefing we recount in the book, and here's what we've got. We've got $10 million coming out of this bank account, and the acting U.S. attorney says in D.C., who outside this room knows about this investigation? And everybody walks out of the meeting saying, well, that's the end of that. They're really not going to go after Trump and look at this seriously.
Could you talk as well, Aaron, about the federal judge's reactions on when Bill Barr was attorney general and there were investigations of Roger Stone and Michael Flynn?
Again, these were, you know, cases where prosecutors and agents who worked these, who felt these cases were, you know, really locked down. I mean, in Flynn's case, you had someone who admitted twice to the FBI having lied to investigators with Stone. They had, you know, evidence that he'd, you know, tried to extort or, you know, push one of the witnesses in the case not to testify. And there, in that case, prosecutors from political appointees from Maine Justice working under Bill Barr had said, we're going to take this a different direction. We're going to not have the sentencing recommendation as many years, 9 years, as you've looked at and assigned as appropriate under the federal sentencing guidelines. That's too much. And you know, some of this came out in the open, but there were the conversations inside the Department of Justice, inside the U.S. Attorney's Office, where you could really feel the pressure brought to bear on these line attorneys. In the Flynn case, there's even an episode that's new to the book where one of the prosecutors, when they are ultimately dropping the case against Flynn, the prosecutors are brought in and said, you signed this document that is filing for court that says, you know, you didn't, you know, we're going to drop the case, that there's no reason to investigate it. And if you, and in that filing were lines that said, and the U.S. government says there's, you've done no wrongdoing in trying to, you know, seek out this prosecution of Flynn. Well, it was kind of a carrot, and the stick later comes when they decide they're not going to sign it, and the government and under Barr, the political appointees take out those lines from the filing, and so then that exposes the prosecutors for the government to lawsuits, to internal investigations of whether they had acted appropriately in trying to seek a conviction of Michael Flynn.
You know, you asked about the judge's reaction, though, and that's, I love Aaron's summary, but the judge's reaction in the bench at the time was horror that Bill Barr was Donald Trump's AG, was forcing the prosecutors to do something different than what they would normally do. And they were furious. And the federal judge, who was the chief judge of that court, told the acting U.S. attorney that had been inserted by inserted by Bill Barr, to basically kill the Flynn case and to scale back the Roger Stone sentencing. The federal judge, we learned, had a meeting with that acting U.S. attorney and said, I'm sorry, we can no longer support you to continue as the chief prosecutor for the land. I can't support you. My bench can't support you. What you've done here is just beyond the pale. And that's never been reported. Eventually, that acting U.S. attorney retreated and basically gave up the job because there was no legal way for them to stay.
If you can talk about January 6th, if you can talk about what happened and didn't happen with the investigation within the Justice Department under Merrick Garland, and how the January 6th investigative committee in Congress forced his hand, explain what was missed and not missed, and even the day before January 6th.
Thank you, Amy. That's so important in this sort of tragedy in three acts. Our book, Injustice, is essentially three presidencies and how DOJ was rocked and reeling from these three experiences. In December of 2020, a little-known investigative arm of the National Archives, an investigator there named Waleska McClellan, is learning that fake elector certificates appear to be coordinated, that a series of swing states, they had Republicans who signed these fraudulent documents. And she's wondering, isn't this a crime? Isn't this a basic mail fraud crime? People pretending that Donald Trump won the election in their state. And she urges the Department of Justice to look at this. She reaches out to some prosecutors they know, and she gets brushed back. January 8th, she's told, yeah, we're not going to look into it. Now, let's be fair, prosecutors in D.C. at that moment are completely drowning in what? The Capitol riot. They know that they have thousands of people they have to investigate for violent attacks on police officers with batons, with fire extinguishers, with flagpoles. And so you can sort of see why they take a pass. But in December of 2020, there is a federal investigator saying, I think there's a crime here. Attorney General Merrick Garland's office believes they need to turn the page from Donald Trump and not look at this top of the top of the conspiracy. Let's look at the little rioters and see if it builds. Let's see where that leads. Let's follow those facts. But then, to your question, Amy, when the House Select Committee begins in the fall, basically October of 2021, looking into this, it's like a little U.S. Attorney's Office, a little engine that could, and they go crazy trying to uncover these facts. I say crazy because they worked at an insane pace that I don't think many prosecutors could work at. Depositions all day long, prepping for them. Long story short, and what people need to know is that team's revelations ultimately embarrass and press the Department of Justice a full 12 months later to open a grand jury investigation into the fake electors and the conspiracy by Donald Trump and his campaign to interfere in that election.
And Carol, you talk about January 6th itself. Your narrative puts the readers sort of at the FBI command center, and as agents are even reporting guns in the crowd, and how the FBI and the Justice Department reacted in those hours.
Yeah, it's a really, Aaron and I spent a lot of our lives writing a Pulitzer Prize winning series about January 6th and what happened before those days. What kind of warnings did the FBI and law enforcement and the White House have? But I'm so glad you asked the question, because even we were taken aback by how on a back foot the FBI was about the multiple alerts that and warnings they were getting of a domestic terror attack in the planning stages. We have internal emails now and exchanges and dialogue within the FBI where they are receiving warnings. Guys are talking about coming here with guns. People are coming and talking about where they can hide their guns and how they can stage them and not have them withdrawn from them or not caught with them. The degree to which the FBI was, again, reticent to believe and reticent to investigate all of the clues of a domestic terror attack are sort of gobsmacking. And it's not entirely shocking, because they were dealing with a president at the time, Donald Trump, who was trying to fire their FBI director, Chris Wray, and who had just days before the attack on the Capitol on January 3rd tried to attempt a coup of his own Department of Justice and replace his acting attorney general on January 3rd with one who would do his bidding, who would take on his political errand and try to interfere in the election and throw doubt into Georgia's election. People don't even remember all the things that happened, but that night, January 3rd, Donald Trump threatened to remove Jeffrey Rosen, install him with Jeffrey Clark, who was saying he would get the election tossed in Georgia, and use the Department of Justice levers to do it, something that's never happened.
We only have a minute to go. I want to go from Aaron to Carol. What shocked you most?
Just the degree, I think, to which, you know, as Carol said it, there was, you know, this moment in time when investigators are saying, why aren't you, when the prosecutor's saying, why aren't you FBI moving faster and looking at this? And one of the guys inside the FBI says, you have to realize, they're stepping over the bodies of Crossfire Hurricane. You know, they still are so reluctant to go at Trump and look at this investigation, goes directly at him because of what has happened in that first Trump term. And we really found there was a continuum over these 10 years that brought, you know, really impacted the time and how quickly they would investigate Trump.
And Carol?
I think the most shocking thing, it's hard to put it in one word, but I think the most shocking thing was how many brave, stubbornly brave people there were who tried to do the right thing and could not succeed in this institution that is built on doing the right thing without fear or favor.
We've been speaking with Carol Lenig and Aaron C. Davis, both Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporters. Their new book is out today. It's Injustice: How Politics and Fear Vanquished America's Justice Department. That does it for our show. I'll be in St. Louis on Friday, speaking in the Q&A after the film Steal This Story, Please, plays in two theaters in St. Louis. Check our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.